You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 4th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So is everybody surviving the coronavirus apocalypse?
No.
I'm sorry to hear
You're not surviving?
I feel very scared.
I would not know it was happening if not for the insanity that is social media. Yeah, and the news.
Yeah.
Like, I'd have no idea. It's good that we know. It's good that we, you know, can plan. And it's, but I still think it's like, calm the F down, people. Like, we got to strike a good balance here.
Yeah, exactly. There's got to be a balance. It's a disease of international concern.
Yeah, totally.
But, so I ran the numbers today because I wrote about it on Science Based Medicine. So far, 94,200 confirmed cases, 3,219 deaths. The percentage varies depending on how you count it. It's like 2-3% of all cases, but about 6% of completed cases, meaning people who have recovered or died.
Mm-hmm.
But, and also, do you count the asymptomatic people or not? So
exactly, are we underrepresenting the amount of people who have the disease?
Probably, because how can we really have a count on that?
It seems like there's basically two forms of the disease. Either you get a mild cold or you get a severe respiratory illness.
And is that the two different mutations?
I don't know. Or if it's just, you know, where it gets into your system. Like if it gets into your lungs, then you get the SARS, you know. So anyway, just for the convention, the naming convention, the name of the virus is SARS-CoV-2, right?
I know, it's confusing.
Yeah. And the name of the disease is COVID-19. So it's a coronavirus disease 2019 or COVID-19.
But people are still calling it the novel coronavirus left and right.
I know, just
once,
says the,
like
once
a
the name sticks, it's,
yeah, that's it. It got tagged, and that's how people know
and
it.
And that is explanatory, right? The novel coronavirus is the newest coronavirus that we know.
Yeah, as long as you add in the 2019.
Yeah, it won't be novel forever.
Exactly.
The WHO doesn't use the word pandemic anymore, where the CDC does.
Oh,
but everyone still is talking about a pandemic. They're talking about pandemic preparedness.
Just fair.
Which makes sense.
It is spreading fast.
All right, so let's talk about that real quick. Prepare how? Right? Is it just for people like us? Do we need to buy, you know, the face masks? Do we get more food? What do you recommend?
Well, I've been reading over and over that you should actually just be mindful and reasonable when you go out to buy things like face masks and hand sanitizer, because a lot of paranoid people are buying up the supplies and there aren't enough supplies available in certain, especially rural areas, for like the medical workers and the first line workers who need them.
Mm-hmm. Gee whiz.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically what this means is, plan your travel strategically. You don't want to end up somewhere where you might get quarantined. If you do have to travel, wash your hands all the time. 15 seconds with soap, right? Wash your hands. That's the single most effective.
Seconds.
You know, that's fine.
15 plus.
that's the single most effective method.
Steve, does more time really make a difference?
It does.
Why?
Yeah, because you're rubbing. It's the physical washing that does it. It really is. It's the scrubbing. You know, that's what does it.
Scrubbing action.
Right, and it's in that sense it's better than the hand sanitizers because the scrubbing will actually get a lot of that stuff off, you know, it'll get it off your hand. If whatever is on your hand, it'll get it off. So I've been doing a 1-2, wash my hands and then do the hand sanitizer. I mean, it's not critical that you do that or anything, but it just makes me feel better.
Are we going to be overusing things like hand sanitizer in these kinds of situations?
We are. There's been runs on
the baseline
on
is already that we're overusing it. So now that's stepped up.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's no word in that.
It's actually justified when you're in the middle of an epidemic.
And also, don't touch your face, right?
Yeah, that's
like a big one.
That's why you wash your hands, because you can't not touch your face.
Yeah, but at least be mindful of it. Yeah. Like they say that in a lot of cases when, you know how you're always saying, Steve, when used correctly, when we talk about the mask, when used correctly. A big reason that a lot of people don't use them correctly is they constantly touch their face to readjust it.
I know. The other thing is, I would say, if you are sick, don't be a hero, man. Stay home. You know, get attention.
Don't be a villain.
don't think, oh, I'm going to work through my illness. You know, just stay home.
Wait, Steve, more importantly, if you are a manager or you own a company or you're a CEO, for crying out loud, let your employees stay home when they're sick.
Yeah.
Like, what is this? What is this whole thing, tough it up and go to work nonsense? Well, it's ridiculous.
I don't know. many companies preaching that. Are they actually saying that?
Hello, American dream.
Yeah, no, seriously.
If your job is not amenable to telecommuting, then yeah, the company, of course, wants to get everybody in. Still a bottom line.
I think we're seeing like two extremes here, right? Like I probably, my family has wanted me to go on this like family cruise lately. I wonder if they're still going to be going on it. I ain't walking on a cruise ship. I was freaked out to do it before. I definitely wouldn't do it during this kind of situation. Mm. That said, we got an email recently from somebody who was saying, I had a friend cancel lunch because they're concerned about the coronavirus. Are they taking it too far?
That's premature. It's like,
you know, I guess it depends on where you live. Is there an outbreak? You know, how busy is
Wuhan,
the place you're
maybe.
Going?
You're in Wuhan.
Yeah, exactly. I think this person was in Seattle, and of course, that does seem to be the epicenter of what's going on in America. Yeah. But
we were just there.
Yep.
I know, we missed it.
That's a little scary.
Yeah, that is a bit scary.
I gave you the numbers for the novel coronavirus, right, for COVID-19. It was so far a little bit over 3,000 people have died. How many people die each year in a typical flu season?
12 to 60,000.
In the U.S. or globally?
Give me both.
40,000 U.S.
40,000 globally.
250,000 global.
It's 12 to 60,000 people in the
U.S. 646,000 people worldwide.
Wow.
646,000.
Over half a million people.
Can you imagine if we had a new, if the COVID-19 was killing 40,000 Americans and half a million people worldwide, the panic that would be happening?
Right. And it happens every year. It's just like,
this is like every year.
Perspective.
Yeah.
Thing is, it's because it's new and it's because we're not used to it. And they are saying that eventually it may become just a community disease, right?
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing. The mortality rate, however you slice it up, we won't know until it's totally done and we can count hard numbers, but it is higher. Yeah. So if it does spread to the scale of a flu season, the mortality rate could be in the tens of millions. The number of people who die could be in the tens of millions.
Well, part of the reason it's higher, don't you think, is because we don't have a vaccine for it yet. We have a vaccine for the flu.
Yeah, but right. But I'm talking about this in over the next year.
Yeah.
You know, this is what we might see. That's the worst case scenario, but it's totally within the range of possible outcomes here.
Yeah. And I mean, seen it with 1918 Spanish flu. Things were different back then. We didn't have the medicine that we have, but we did have vaccines and it hit us hard and we weren't ready for it.
Right. But there was a world war that kind of had something to do with
that. That's how we brought it home.
Right. Well, yeah.
And that's why I think a little bit of obsession with this and even calling it a pandemic to really get people's attention even more, I think it's worth it because this could be terrible, but it's not like it's not going to reach a level of like a Spanish flu scenario. I think that's kind of clear at this point. It could be horrible, but it's not anywhere near worst case scenario. And if we hopefully this will focus the world on how real this can be and how bad it can be. And just over the past few years, I mean, didn't we gut a lot of our pandemic SWAT teams? I mean, it was just like we got to like stop that
and take it
seriously and not use it like, oh, let's save money and cut and save a few million dollars.
Yeah, pandemic. We won't have one of those, will we?
Yeah, the U.S. response has been slow and not great because, like, the testing kits were way too expensive. They've been out of reach. There haven't been enough of them. It's been, you know, we're also seeing a big, I think, divide between rich and poor. We mentioned before this idea of don't go to work. Well, some people just have to go to work.
Yeah, unless you're getting paid leave. Unless basically people have to say, listen, if you are sick, paid leave, stay home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And some companies are doing that.
But there are people who are like, I'm paranoid. I want to telecommute. And other people are like, no, I have to go in and risk it. Even if I'm not sick right now, there was a guy who was coughing in the cube next to me and I just have to risk it. And that sucks. Yeah. I mean, it sucks, but
if you're sick, you know, give it a day. Call your HR department and say, look, I've got something, you know, I want to see how this plays out. Can I please work from home for a day or two just to see what this turns into? I mean, you just got to get real.
But you can't do that if you're like a fast food worker or, you know, it's like, it's just, it's
or
not
a teacher.
The
some
for
jobs,
most,
you just can't do it.
Yeah. For
it's,
most
a much
jobs, hard,
it's a much
so.
Harder decision.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will keep track of it. It's just, it's continuing apace. It hasn't slowed down really. And the thing, maybe it's slowing down in Wuhan, but it's picking up in other countries, you know, like Spain, South Korea. Italy. Italy apparently is having a real
Italy's
real
bad
outbreak
right now. Yeah.
Do you think it's because we're now living through whatever our learning curve? Like, it slowed down in Wuhan. Is it because they've gotten more of a handle on it, or because it's run through the population?
Yeah,
already?
It runs through the population. Yeah, that's gotcha. When it starts to slow down, when there's just fewer people who are susceptible.
But not just slow down. I read that historically, viruses like this, the initial phase is rougher, it's tougher, and then the virus mutates in such a way that it's less harmful to the host. So we could see a drop below a mortality rate lower than what we're seeing now once it kind of settles into the population. So that's something that's a little bit of good news, that
but it could mutate in a way that makes it harder to treat. You never know how it's going to mutate. I mean, it may be that the vaccine they're developing now is like ineffective by the time
yikes
they develop it. So yeah, that's something. The
early indications are that it's pretty, that the vaccine should be stable. But we will see. We have good targets. The targets seem stable. They seem to be effective. But again, it'll take 1 to 2 years to get them.
And I guess we don't know yet if it's going to have a season similar to seasonal influenza, where it might actually die down. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it probably will. Again, because coronaviruses are do not spread. Last as long on stuff in the heat, and they do not spread as easily in the heat.
Interesting.
So it's possible, like when the real summer heat hits the northern hemisphere, it may slow down up here, but then the winter will be hitting in the southern hemisphere, and we may get that seasonal hemispheric cycle where it winters in the southern hemisphere,
waxes and
then,
and wanes.
Yeah.
So if you live by the equator, then or in the tropics, you're safer.
That's right. Yeah. That's
But you have other diseases.
You got other diseases
to worry about.
Well, why don't we just kill everyone that lives in the southern hemisphere then, and that'll stop it from coming back?
Yeah, we kill off one hemisphere. Yeah, that's great, Jay.
Or Jay, we could just have them all move to the northern hemisphere. That would be the slightly more humane thing to do.
That sounds horrible too. How about we just develop a vaccine?
Or we just develop a vaccine.
Yeah. I wonder if CRISPR help out with this?
I don't know.
I'm sure they're using it.
How?
I don't know.
To mutate the genetics of...
You mean to do something proactive? I thought you meant, are they utilizing CRISPR in their...
No, do something proactive.
In their research.
Take the coronavirus and kind of neuter it and then spread that all over the place.
But that's kind of what a vaccine is, Bob, right? It's a live virus vaccine is a neutered virus that you spread around with the vaccine to develop immunity.
But use CRISPR, sure, man, because CRISPR is cool.
But that's what I'm saying, Bob.
Just use it
more often.
We just want people to use it.
If CRISPR can help, I'm sure they're already using it.
Legit, if you could have an app in the future that says, in your town today, you have a greater, a 20% chance. Based on how this disease is spreading in your town, you have an increased likelihood of catching this in your town. That kind of stuff could be invaluable, and hopefully they'll start going in that direction.
Or cause more panics.
You're saying we need to AI the shit out of it? Is that what you're saying?
AI, of course, would be great. But, just computer, straight up computer modeling just to track what could happen based on the information you have available.
Bob, I have a question.
To help you make better decisions. Yes.
Bob, I got a question. Jeez. What's the difference between valuable and invaluable?
The same as flammable and inflammable.
It means
it flams
very.
Or it doesn't.
Invaluable is more valuable than valuable.
Yeah, it means very.
Invaluable is like irreplaceable, right?
Yeah, if something is invaluable, you can't even put a price tag on it.
I read that it's not a word.
it's a perfectly cromulent word. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. The word if you
used,
use it, damn it.
We are moving on. Word. Evan, you are going to give us an entry of Swindler's List telling us about tax scams.
Well, I'll start with this. We all know the expression, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. You've heard that, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I'm an accountant by day, in case listeners didn't know that. And to accountants, everything looks like a tax-related issue. It's true, and it's especially true in the first 100 days of the year as we hurtle towards our April 15th tax deadlines, here in the United States at least. Now, skepticism and taxes often intersect at the corner of Scam Avenue and Fraud Street. Look it up. So, and especially this time of year, for me, my skepticism, my activities in skepticism, and my work, they tend to overlap. They will blend. So this is a good time as any to remind folks everywhere, especially here in America where it is tax season, about the dangers of scam artists stealing people's money and their identities through tax-related scams. Let me give you an example that leads to a recent news item. Has anyone here, I'm talking to my four co-hosts here. Have you guys ever gotten calls from people claiming to be from the Internal Revenue Service or the Social Security Administration? You get those calls?
Yes, but they're always a robot.
They're robocalls is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, but it's a robot voice. Hello, this is the Internal Revenue. It's like, yo, come on, try a little harder than that, please.
Well, not all of those robo scams are alike, you know, because they do actually have some people who are on the other ends of those phones, or they actually, once they get past the robot level of it all, they'll get to a human, and that's where the scam will happen. And there's lots of vulnerable people out there, especially older people who will fall for these. But I have a bit of good news for us all, and this is the recent news item. A man has been convicted of crimes for having run several call center scams that victimized thousands of taxpayers and the United States government.
Ooh.
Yeah, he entered a guilty plea in the United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas. Giddy up. Now, hearing that just by itself is good news, right, Kara? But the details make this particular caller more impressive due to the scope of the crimes and the effort it took to bring him in. The fella's name is Hitesh Patel, also known as Hitesh Hinglaj. He's age 43, and he's from Ahmedabad, India. This guy was operating and funding call centers, which defrauded thousands of victims out of tens of millions of dollars between 2013 and 2016.
Jeez.
Now, according to his plea admission, Patel said he and co-conspirators headed a scheme where employees at these call centers impersonated Internal Revenue Service and United States Citizenship and Immigration Service officials, and victims were threatened with arrests, with imprisonment, fines, deportation, if they did not pay money to the government. Patel's team was trained to impersonate these people, not only from IRS and Citizen and Immigration, but also they hit the Canadian Revenue Agency, the Australian Tax Office, and other agencies such as the U.S. government grant providers, payday loan officers, and other debt collectors. So it was a whole ring going on under this one guy who basically was training all these people to do these things. Now, Patel admitted that according to the evidence against him, he caused no less than $25 million of damages and theft and upwards of $65 million. So in the end, the result was guilty of wire fraud, guilty of identification fraud, guilty of access device fraud, money laundering, impersonating a federal officer or employee, guilty on all charges. And this was no small feat to bring him in, because it's super difficult not only to locate these kinds of scammers, many of which are in foreign countries, but to actually successfully capture them and extradite them to the United States. I mean, this becomes a case in which other criminals around the world, they're going to be put on warning that you may not be as safe as you think you are just because you're operating outside the United States of America. The list of agencies that had to work in concert just to get this one particular guy in his ring, here it is. Here's the list. Department of Justice, IRS, Department of Homeland Security, Office of Inspector General, the HSA, ICE, the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration. And that's just in the United States alone. Now, this guy was picked up in Singapore, so you had to also recognize those equivalent departments in Singapore as well, who helped wrangle this guy and bring him to justice in America. Patel's sentencing is set for April 3rd. He faces up to 25 years in prison, a possible fine of $250,000, or twice the gross gain or loss from his offense. So it could be in the tens or if not $100 million. It depends on what the judge says. What about the other people in his ring? They got them too. 24 domestic defendants associated with the scheme have been convicted and sentenced to terms of up to 20 years in prison. And they were located in Texas, Arizona, and Georgia. So this is a feel-good story to this particular swindler's list. And I have a couple of tax hygiene tips to share with people.
All right, let's do it.
Especially during this time of year, tax time. And these are things I'm telling my clients, and now I am sharing them with you.
Way, how much are you going to charge us?
By the hour, it's, yeah, well, you'll see. We'll talk later.
Okay. I heard H. It was 100-something.
A haircut.
A haircut.
Too busy.
Your parents and your grandparents, they are the top victims. The elderly, senior citizens, they're the most likely to have a nest egg of their own and excellent credit, which makes them very attractive to con artists. You know, these were people who in our cases, grew up in either the 30s, 40s, 50s. They were raised to be polite and trusting, and con artists exploit these traits in people, knowing that it's very difficult or impossible for these individuals to say no or just hang up the telephone. So the older Americans are less likely to report a fraud as well, because they either don't know who to report it to, or they're too ashamed for having been scammed, or they don't even realize that they've been scammed. So we all need to kind of do our part, help our families, help our neighbors, especially if they're elderly, and try to keep an eye out for them. Ask them how they're doing. Have they received any calls lately from suspicious agencies or people who said that they were with the IRS or some other enforcement agency? It just takes a little bit of prevention, and it can go a long way in helping them. A few other things that I will mention as well. The IRS does not initiate contact with taxpayers by email, by text messages, certainly not by telephone calls unsolicited or unprovoked. And they don't use social media channels either. But all these things, all these avenues of communication are being utilized by swindlers and con artists to get information on you.
How do they contact you, Ev?
How do they?
By mail.
Mail actually also. And yeah. I was going to bring that up as well, because they're getting a little more sophisticated and the con artists are starting to use the U.S. Postal Service. And
well, then
mail.
We can get them on mail fraud.
Exactly, right. A whole extra set of charges.
Yeah.
But that is, everything is done by mail. But since the con artists have realized that this is the trend, they are starting to target that as well. And they're putting out some pretty impressive letters and documents that absolutely look authentic and would be very difficult for the average person to tell. So what we inform people is that if you get a letter from the IRS or any tax agency, whether it's state, local, or federal, inform your accountant. Let them know. Let them help you determine what is true, what is not true, and how to appropriately respond or report it as the fraud it may be. You also have to look out for those people who you are using professional preparers to prepare their tax returns. So another scam that's been happening, they're calling them ghost preparers. Now, these are people who will help people put together a tax return, but they won't sign it themselves. Now, and that's illegal. You cannot do that. If you're being paid to prepare for taxes, you must absolutely have a preparer tax identification number, a P10. I have one, obviously. They all must have them. If there's no P10, it is not legal. So be aware of that as well. And one last thing I'll tell you about, the IRS for the first time is offering identity protection pins voluntarily. In other words, you don't have to be how it used to work is that you had to be a victim of identity theft, and the IRS would send you a letter with a pin, and that pin would then be associated with your tax return. It's a two-step authorization or authentication process. You use the PIN, you match it with your Social Security. If the two match up, then the IRS knows that the tax return that's being submitted is legitimate. But for the first time, and they're experimenting with it in about 10 states or so, you can voluntarily ask, hey, IRS, I want a PIN to file with my taxes. And they will allow that to happen. And they think this is going to be actually popular, and they will roll it out to eventually all 50 states. And the two-step authentication will be the norm going forward in the coming years. So those are the tax tips I have for you. This has been Swindler's List. I hope you learned a few things. And as I always say, if you have any questions about your taxes, ask your accountant.
Don't ask Evan. Ask your accountant.
But if you want to hire me as your accountant.
Unless you want to hire Evan as your accountant.
Oh my God.
Hey, Evan, I have to answer medical questions all the time. I think you can answer a few pro bono questions every now and then.
Yeah, if we get them, I'm happy to chip in on that.
Yeah, but I think, and the bottom line to keep in mind is, right, the government's never going to cold call you and ask you for any identifying information. And I have a basic rule. I never give any identifying information to anybody who initiates contact with me.
Yes.
Yeah, if you called them, that's different. Yeah,
that's right.
And hopefully you didn't call them as a response to an email.
No, right. No, you looked up the phone number and called them. Yeah. You initiated it.
And I did say it earlier, but I will reiterate it. The IRS or these agencies will not initiate via phone call. That doesn't mean that they won't have back and forth phone calls with people, but only after a particular case has been initiated. And that always takes place through written letters back and forth, and then phone calls follow on that specific topic. That is it.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
So, guys, this is a very interesting controversy that has been simmering in the literature for the last decade or so. The question of whether or not fossils from dinosaurs, or they're 65 million years or older, can have soft tissue, right? So there's been another article published presenting evidence, alleged evidence, of not only proteins, but also DNA in a duck-billed dinosaur, a specimen of a Hypacrosaurus. So this is by a researcher who has been basically the primary researcher claiming this sort of evidence.
Oh, it's the same person most of the time?
Yeah, it really is.
That's a red flag, yeah. Right?
Yeah, this is Mary Schweitzer. And it also doesn't help that at the beginning of her career, she was a young Earth creationist. But she isn't anymore. So she basically studied under Jack Horner, and Horner convinced her with the evidence that, yeah, evolution happened and the world is ancient.
That's impossible.
But I do think that
that's pretty cool.
Kind of complicates, you know, her story.
As it should.
Also, young Earth creationists are jumping on this evidence, claiming it disproves an ancient Earth, right?
What? Why?
Because if you can't have proteins that are 70 million years old. So if there are proteins in dinosaur fossils, the dinosaurs are not 70 million years old. They're 10,000 years old. Yeah, so this just poisons the whole question, right? But if we put all of that aside and say, oh, let's just look at the scientific evidence. So she... Again, in this new paper, she's collaborating with a team from China on this analysis. But she's claiming to have found, you know, collagen proteins. Now, this would be huge because it would take paleontology into the realm of molecular, you know, biology. So, which we have done for things that are thousands of years old. Like Neanderthals, right? So we can now...
Yeah, and things that are frozen, right?
Yeah, things that are frozen or things that are... Even if they're not frozen, you know, you can still extract some mitochondria, whatever, some soft tissue, like some DNA from bones, from bone marrow inside fossils, you know? Mm. So we've been able to sequence the Neanderthal genome. So far, there does not appear to be any evidence that DNA can survive for 60 million years. So what is the evidence against... Let's just stick with the DNA for a minute, against ancient DNA, millions of years old.
Well, there's a half-life, right? There's a half-life to the DNA.
Yeah.
It degrades.
Yeah, so there's DNA has a half-life. The half-life has been estimated at 521 years. That doesn't mean after 521 years it's all gone. It means half of the bonds have been broken. And so if you calculate that out... How long would it take for every last bond to be broken? And that is about 6.8 million years, which is still a long time.
Well, that is,
yes. Yeah, but that means impressive. That you were looking at 0.00001%. Yeah. That's that laid out. It would be like you'd be pretty damn lucky to find that.
Scraping the last few molecules.
Yeah, but 6.8 million years is when there's zero information left, right?
So at 5 million, you'd be pretty lucky to get any viable.
Yeah, so from a practical point of view, mm-hmm. you know, what's the longest period of time where you would have DNA sequences long enough that you can sequence them, right? That you can find them.
What is it, like 500,000 or something?
Yeah, so it's like 500,000. Yeah, so maybe 1.5. I think the oldest claim is the oldest protein that's been confirmed and generally accepted is about 1.7 million years old. The oldest DNA is like 700,000 years old.
And you would think that would have to be almost like in amber, or like there'd be some sort of like time capsule.
It was in a frozen. It was in a
alien,
frozen.
Yeah, laying out in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, so it's
Steve,
a big leap.
It wouldn't last at like, you know, if you threw a piece of meat on the ground.
Yeah.
No, it has to be in something, right?
As again, the oldest one was a 700,000-year-old horse, you know, frozen in ice, and we were able to sequence some of its DNA. So it's a big leap from 700,000 years to 60 million years.
Yeah, just a bit.
Especially if the evidence seems to show that over 6 million is basically impossible.
That's what the evidence shows. Yeah. So needless to say, there's a lot of skepticism about these results. And because it's coming from the same researcher, you know, one of the, you know, the researchers who has been making this claim for years, specifically soft tissue, it, the bigger picture, not, this is the first one for DNA, but this is coming from the person who's been claiming collagen and, you know, soft tissue, in very ancient specimens, dinosaurs. That hasn't gained widespread acceptance, in the scientific community. So what do they say about this evidence? The big criticism is
we can't replicate it.
Well, yeah, yeah. There are a lot of research like I can't replicate it, so I don't believe it. And that's basically what they say. But they're saying, you know, you can't rule out contamination.
Oh yeah, that's the first thing I would think of is collagen. I'd be like, that's probably yo collagen.
Yeah,
not it's collagen.
Or in one of the first papers, it turned out to be ostrich collagen, which was probably contaminated from other specimens in the same lab. But also, it could be ancient contamination, right? Like the contamination could have been
a million years ago.
A million years ago, 500,000 years ago.
Yeah, especially if you're when you look at fossils that aggregate in places, like if you're looking at the tar pits here, or like, you know, those bear pits where there's like layers of species, all in one specific place.
And also bacteria gets everywhere.
And don't forget, you know, sometimes animals can be like really mean and they're like, yeah, I'm going to screw up some scientist in a million years. I'm going to contaminate this.
But it's an interesting question of like, what? Where's the line of real science, you know? So the researcher, you know, Schweitzer, to her credit, I think she's doing sincere and rigorous science. And she has responded to the criticism by tightening up her protocol and basically addressing their methodological criticism. But it still remains a problem that her claims seem implausible and other scientists are not able to exactly replicate her work. Now, there are other researchers who are finding other avenues of evidence that maybe there's some ancient soft tissue here and there. You know, I think that maybe is a slightly open question, but again, the evidence is not solid enough that it is generally accepted. So this is controversial. These are controversial claims. It's real. These are genuinely scientifically controversial, and it hasn't broken through because inherently implausible based on what we do know.
Right.
Not impossible. It just would be a big change to what we think we already know. And there's this replication problem that is really keeping people from jumping on board with this.
So is the question here, it's less about DNA and it's more about proteins.
Well, it's both.
Right?
In this study, it's both. But the longer claim has been about proteins. Now she's throwing DNA on the pile saying, yep.
And
on top of that, I have dino DNA, which actually makes her previous claims less plausible.
I know. I was going to say, like, the controversy seems to be about the proteins, and the DNA seems to almost be like people are like,
let's deepen the controversy, right, by adding DNA. And then also, I think, if anything, it works against her credibility. Because now you're just making you're making even more implausible claims.
Was this peer-reviewed, this study?
Oh, yeah. It's legit science. It's just controversial because the, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and the evidence is not strong enough to convince the scientific community because it's inherently implausible. But, you know,
do they hedge? So, is there language in the discussion? Like, is it really emphatic, or is it very like, you know?
It's scientific, but it doesn't pull its punches. It says there is convincing evidence of protein, you know. But this is how science is supposed to work, right? You have a new extraordinary claim. You gotta come up with the goods, right? You gotta provide the evidence, and the rest of the community should be damn skeptical. These are the questions they should be asking.
That's the point.
And you have to survive multiple attempts at proving your claims wrong before you should be taken seriously. And the threshold is appropriately high.
Does she have a blind spot, Steve?
Well, every scientist has a blind spot towards their own research. That's a good baseline assumption. Everyone wants to, I mean, I think like in her case, she's either destined to win a Nobel Prize or to be a cautionary tale footnote on the history of science, right? She's good. One of those two extremes awaits her legacy. And of course she wants to be at the Nobel Prize end of the spectrum, of course. But every scientist wants to be at the end of the spectrum rather than, oh, I spent 20 years basically proving that my ideas were wrong. You know, that's still science. We still sort of a negative result is still a result. It's just not as satisfying on any level, right? To being proven, to have your ideas be proven correct. So yeah, you get invested in your own ideas, which is why replication is so important. It's so important. It's got to be universal. Like, it doesn't matter who you are or what your motivation is. If you do the process, you should get the same results. And if other people can't replicate a result, that is a forever question mark until that problem is solved.
Cold fusion.
Yeah, exactly. It's the ESP. I mean, it's so many things. There's so many areas of research where people are doing semi-legitimate research, but it's just not cracking through because of these problems, plausibility, replicability, et cetera. Again, I think this is towards the more scientific end of the spectrum, but it's just there's a huge plausibility problem here. Cool story, though. And again, everyone hopes that she's correct. I hope that she's correct.
Of course. Paleontologists would blow the field open.
If we could extend molecular biology to the tens of millions of years, that would be such a great avenue of research, you know?
Yeah, until we get a time machine, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Working on it.
Bob, come on.
So that pans out.
You know how costly it would be to fuel a time machine?
$9
yeah,
a liter.
Yeah, you're right, Jay.
Yeah, you know how many chronotrons that would take?
And graviolis? Oh, forget about it.
The graviolis. Okay. Kara, you sent me this news item on whether or not we should use wetlands versus levees. I thought this is something we've never talked about before. So what's going on here?
I don't know if you guys remember the hurricane in Houston.
Oh, we talked about it.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show. This one hit home for me a little bit because, you know, I'm from Texas. I have a lot of friends who still live there. I have a friend who's a radiologist who was stuck in her hospital for 72 hours. Yeah. Whoa. And I feel like the common kind of consensus after this hurricane was things were so bad and the city remained flooded for so long. Number one, because it just hovered and they dumped more rain on – they got more rain dumped on them than they had in a really long time. But number two – because Houston has so much concrete and there aren't these active sinks, that there's nowhere for the water to go. And so, you know, I've for a long time had this idea in my mind that wetlands are these natural buffers against massive storm surges. But if you look at most of human history, at least modern human developmental history, the interesting thing is that when trying to mitigate against hurricane or flood disasters, this is usually left up to civil engineers. And civil engineers, they build stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So we're often thinking about walls and levees and sandbagging. And like these are the types of things that we think of when we think of how do we keep water out of a city.
Physical barriers.
You want grass, don't you?
Well, that's the thing, right? So what's so interesting is I just started watching last night. It's such a coincidence, Steve, that I always send Steve 5 story choices for the week. And randomly last night, I started watching an old episode of American Experience, which is one of my favorite documentary series on TV. Yeah, and it's usually aired on PBS. Mm-hmm. And there's an episode all about the Florida Keys, or about the Everglades, I'm sorry, in Florida, and how over like the last almost 200 years, these land prospectors have been claiming that they can drain the Everglades and make them suitable for development, mm-hmm. or suitable for agriculture. And people bought in hook, line, and sinker.
Well, yeah,
and this was like unified people. And it really wasn't until like, you know, people like Marjorie Stoneman Douglas and all of these different activists who really pushed hard to say, no, we need to maintain the Everglades as an ecological, you know, wonder and a national park. But anyway, so here comes this question that I think a lot of people say, okay, well, isn't it good, like you said, Jay, to have grass? Like, isn't that helpful with hurricane damage? Yeah, it seems like it, but it turns out there's kind of no evidence. And so these researchers who are economists from Cornell and UCSD decided to actually analyze this from an economic perspective. And they said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at the last 88 hurricanes and storms over the course of 1996 to 2016, so 20 years. And we're going to look at all these different coastal counties across the U.S. And we're just going to dollar for dollar look at the amount of damage and compare that to the amount of wetland ecology, you know, with obviously some adjustments for, you know, infrastructure and things like that. And they found that, you know, the evidence is pretty clear, at least from a correlational perspective, that wetlands seem to reduce the actual physical dollar damage. And we're talking not about damage that comes downstream, like inability to make income from tourism and things like that. But we're physically talking about like buildings falling over, like actual physical damage. And they found that they estimate the average value of a single square kilometer of wetland to be protective to the order of $1.8 million per year.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is in many ways the first, and it's going to be really important to replicate this and to kind of approach it in different kinds of analytical ways. But this is the first of, you know, maybe I can't say it's the absolute first, but it's one of the most recent, strongest economic investigations into the actual financial benefit of wetlands versus, I guess you could say, the civil engineering thing. So they didn't directly compare, you know, dams and levees and things like that. They only looked at the dollar amount of damage in places where there are active ecological wetlands and places where there are not. And they found that there does seem to be a protective effect of wetlands against storm surges or hurricane and like severe rainstorms in these coastal areas that can be calculated in dollars. And so the hope here is that that will actually have an effect in policy change. Whereas historically, I think environmentalists would say, no, we need more of these ecological wetlands. Not only are they going to help, but they're also obviously good for maintaining biodiversity. Now they can actually point to research and they can say dollar for dollar, this is actually a better investment is to restore the wetlands mm-hmm. than to just build more walls, which I think is important, right? You need to see the evidence on paper in order to make an important policy decision.
Yeah. I mean, imagine evidence-based policy making. That would be incredible.
Right. I know. I mean, that's a stretch. We got to figure that one out next, but
dare to dream.
But yeah, it's really
right.
Like, for example, they're saying that Hurricane Irma, they believe that wetland losses are estimated to have increased the property damage from that by $430 million.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so we need more wetlands.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's one of those things where I'm like, duh.
Yeah.
But maybe not duh. Maybe it's like, okay, this thing that seems so obvious, people don't believe or they're fighting against, or for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to make sense on paper. Well, now we're starting to see that evidence on paper as well.
And this is going to get more important as climate change mm-hmm. makes flooding events more likely, more frequent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. I guess I could see why it would feel a bit counterintuitive. Like, why would we want more wet if we're trying to prevent wet? Like, why would we want more flood zones? But that's what flood zones are for, right? Mm. You can't keep the water out at a certain part. You have to learn how to live with the water like they do in places like the Netherlands, right? In low-lying areas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Bob, you're going to tell us about the biggest explosion ever in the universe.
The Big Bang? Mm.
Well, the Big Bang created the universe.
Well, so the second biggest. All right, Evan, second biggest.
Ooh, sorry.
The biggest one after that.
I didn't mean to pop the balloon.
No, that's fine. So scientists have recently revealed evidence of the biggest explosion ever found in the universe, eclipsed only by the Big Bang itself. So this is published in the Astrophysical Journal on February 28th, just recently. So guys, what do you think caused the explosion if you don't have absolute evidence?
Colliding supermassive black holes.
It has to do with black holes, Bob.
Yeah, well, yeah, it does. That's true. My first thought was that they found some epically massive supernova, right? Well, which is kind of related to a black hole because that was the precursor of a black hole. But this was actually caused by a black hole itself. It happened in the...
Just one?
Yes, just one.
Oh, not two of them colliding.
Correct. Now, so this happened in the Ophiuchus galaxy cluster. I'd like to pronounce this...
Ophiuchus,
but some people were pronouncing it Ophiuchus, so whatever.
The wrong
So this is the galaxy cluster, 390 million light years away, so really far. The Ophiuchus supercluster is a nearby galaxy supercluster in the constellation Ophiuchus, right?
Yeah.
So now superclusters, just generic superclusters, are they're collections of clusters or groups of galaxies. So now these are among the largest structures in the entire universe. Now, if you look at the Milky Way is part of the galaxy group that's called the Local Group, right? You've probably heard of the Local Group, Milky Way, Andromeda, and a lot of dwarf galaxies. There's like 54 of them, but that number is kind of variable depending on who you talk to. So that we've got our local group, but that local group is within the Virgo supercluster, and that supercluster is part of the Lanikea supercluster, which I covered a bunch of years ago, which was actually relatively recently discovered. Fascinating topic. So so here's an interesting factoid. I really like this. Superclusters are so big and relatively low in density that they expand with the general expansion of the universe, right? The Hubble expansion. Can
Why would you call that a factoid? Factoids are not or sound true, but aren't true.
We talked about how that word evolved. What was the conclusion? Did I use that properly?
I think the conclusion was that's how it started. That was the original meaning of the word. But now so many people use it to mean just a little fact that is true that that's how most people understand
Okay, that's fine.
We should call them facticles.
So superclusters actually will expand with the expansion of the universe, but clusters and groups don't expand. So that means that our local group of 54 galaxies, if you go ahead a billion or a trillion years, the Hubble expansion will not pull them away from us. So at some point, our entire universe will be just whatever's left of those 54 galaxies that will have emerged into some mega galaxy. So I thought that was interesting. So what happened here? So in the center of the Ophiuchus supercluster is a supermassive black hole in a large galaxy. Okay. Now black holes are mainly thought to what? Suck, right? They suck. They suck really hard, right? It's all about the gravity with a black hole, but that refers to the inside of the event horizon. I mean, you have to get really close to a black hole, and it's not going to reach out and pull you in from you know light years away. You got to get really close, and you got to get within the event horizon before there's like literally no way out of that black hole. But if you think of what's happening the outside of the event horizon, all bets are off because the forces are so titanic, magnetic fields, gravitational pulls, so many things are happening outside that it can actually explosively redirect infalling matter into relativistic jets. These jets that you could sometimes see extending perpendicular to the plane of a galaxy. Now these are beams of ionized matter, right? So you've got an accretion disk of matter swirling, lots of matter. You've got magnetic fields. You've got frame dragging. We're not actually sure where this energy is coming from to create these jets. It could be, I think it's magnetic fields, but it could potentially be frame dragging. But it accelerates this to close to the speed of light, and shooting it out and into these amazingly beautiful polar jets. Now, this happens when mostly with massive black holes, right? You can see these types of relativistic jets in neutron stars, but mainly you're seeing them with massive black holes that are feeding. They need to be actively feeding, actively sucking in gas and stars and even planets. And these are called active galactic nuclei, AGN. That's where you're going to see these jets. So this is what was happening in this Ophiuchus, this large galaxy within this supercluster many, many millions of years ago. So what they did was they found, using Chandra telescope and others, looking at the X-ray data, they found this huge hole in the galaxy back in 2016. But this hole was so big that they didn't seriously consider, you know, what we now know to have happened. It was just way too big. Only when they looked at this data using the modern radio telescopes like the Murchison Wide Field Array and the that's in Australia and the giant meter wave radio telescope in India. Now these were used on this data, and we only then did we say, oh my God, this data fits perfectly with the X-ray data. It has to have been these relativistic jets from an active nuclei that actually caused this. I would have loved to have seen those because, I mean, this is really like fossil evidence. Fossil radio evidence is, I think, that how they refer to this, because this is just so old. You have to infer what happened. You can't just look at the jets because the jets, you know, this black hole is not feeding anymore because the gas kind of moved on. And so the black hole that's there is not active anymore. It's not actively feeding. Now, this created an explosion so big, the cavity is in the gas is so huge that it's five times larger than the second to the event that was in second place. You know, often when we have a record, it's like, oh, it's 10% bigger. It's, you know, it's 15% bigger. No, this is five times bigger than the previous number one. It's just far and away.
Dwarfs it.
And,
yeah.
And that's why the scientists like didn't believe it until they had this radio data.
Makes sense. Yeah, you think something's wrong with your measurements or
yeah, it's like, wait, no, it can't be that. It's got to be. So they had some other explanation that kind of made sense, much more sense, you know, than relativistic jets from a black hole causing it. So the lead author of the study, Dr. Simona Giancintucci from the Naval Research Laboratory in the U.S., she said the blast was similar to the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens, which ripped off the top of the mountain. Now, that's the beginning of her quote. I'm like, where are you going with that? I mean, how are you going to compare this to Mount St. Helens, which was big but had nothing compared to this? She's like, the difference is that you could fit 15 Milky Way galaxies in a row into the crater this eruption punched cool. into the cluster's hot cast.
Oh, that's cool.
15 Milky – I mean, a Milky Way galaxy is –
100,000 light years?
Yeah, 100,000 light years across if you're not accounting – dark matter halos or anything like that. Say 100,000 light years times 15. So that's a huge, huge hole in the gas. The bottom line, though, is that we don't know why it's so big. That's still a mystery. But you can't imagine that this explosion happened like pop. I mean, this happened kind of slowly over hundreds of millions of years. I mean, we're talking about such vast distances in space that that even, you know, relativistic jets take, you know, time to carve out these cavities in the gas. So what was cool is that co-author Dr. Maxim Markovich from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center said that the radio data fit inside the X-rays like a hand in a glove, which reminds me of that Star Trek quote. It fits like a glove, Captain. Which episode?
Oh, God.
It's like a glove, Captain.
Hang on.
I remember. That was the Klingon thing where they put the cloaking device.
No.
They picked up a panel from that station.
Yes. That's, yes. What episode? Come on, people.
I forget the name of the episode.
It fits like a glove, Captain. It's where no man has gone before, the first episode with Chatner. All right. Enough of that. So he also says that this is the clincher that tells us an eruption of unprecedented size occurred. So that was the key information. Once you use the radio telescopes and you fit it into the X-ray data, that's when we knew what happened here. So Professor Johnson Hollett said, going back and doing a multi-wavelength study has really made the difference here. And that is going to be we're going to get a lot of great discoveries in astronomy and astrophysics by going back and studying sections of space and galaxies and clusters that we've already examined. But when you do them in other wavelengths, especially these super sensitive radio telescopes that we have, we're going to discover all sorts of stuff. This may not be the first place for long. We may find other ones that are even bigger with these new tools. So now remember this Murchison wide field array, when they made this discovery, they were using it with a 2,048 antennas, which is a lot. But soon they're going to have almost 4,100 antennas, and it's going to be 10 times more sensitive. So they can go and look at some other clusters, or even this cluster again, with 10 times an order of magnitude the sensitivity, and who knows what they're going to find. So this is just the beginning of these types of discoveries that we really couldn't have made without these tools. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
15 Milky Ways.
Yeah, it's huge. It's fragging huge.
Yeah, which Star Trek episode was that one? Fragging huge, Captain.
None of them. All right.
Okay, good. Episode 8.
Jay, give me a who's that noisy.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. I know, right? A few more seconds. Oh, so many things that it could be. I'm really impressed. I got a lot of wonderful guesses and a lot of really good guesses this week. So I got a guess from a listener named Jim Jeffries, and he said, not the comedian. Yeah. You actually saw Jim Jeffries once, and he was awesome. The guy is hysterical. So Jim said, I knew last week's noisy, a child and a dog, but thought it can't be that, too obvious. I've had numerous chihuahuas and hounds, and most will do it. Oh, well, this week's immediately made me think it was the glass vibration made while rubbing with a wet finger, slowed way down. Love you guys, my favorite podcast. Yeah, many people wrote in that they thought it was a glass, you know, like that whew noise if you wet your finger on a glass that will vibrate. Usually the thinner the glass, the better, because it can vibrate more easily. That's not correct. Next listener, Joe Gabbard, wrote in and said, sounds like a slowed down version of the Star Trek The Next Generation transporter. Now, Joe, you had me with that. I was curious about it. And in fact, this is what Star Trek The Next Generation transporter sounds like slowed down. I slowed down the Star Trek The Next Generation transporter a lot, and it really turns into just this low, incredibly low rumble hum, and it sounds nothing like that, but I just wanted to check to see if they would sound a lot alike. But that was cool, and I enjoyed doing the little bit of time it took to figure that one out. But we had a winner last week, and the winner was named Jace Hastad, and Jace said, was that a slowed down version of the old internet dial-up noise? And in fact, it is the old internet dial-up, the old internet protocol. So let me play it again now that you know what it is, and maybe you'll hear something that sounds familiar. See what I mean?
I don't like. Do not like.
Yes,
that frequency does not agree with you.
I did put a disclaimer in last week that this one is a little hard to hear. So good job, Jace. So what we have here is the old internet dial-up protocol, dial-up modem, slowed down 1,700%.
Jeez.
Very, very slow. Okay. Very cool noise.
Like the connection back in the day.
Yes, right. That's how long it would take to download it. Good noisy. Lots of fun guesses. Thanks a lot, guys. I have a new noisy for this week, and this noisy was sent in by a listener named Kenny McAlpin. Ha-ha! I have you all stumped.
It's a bird.
Howler it's a plane.
Monkeys.
Howler monkeys. So if you you know what this week's noisy is, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And Steve, did you know that we are going to Denver and we're going to be doing a live show that people can attend in Denver on April 24th?
The private shows.
I did know that.
And did you know that the day before April 24th, I cannot formally announce this, I kind of am.
Sounds like you are.
That we will be doing another kind of show that we do called The Extravaganza on the 23rd. That's a Thursday night. And we will give all the details. I was supposed to get them last week. It was delayed a week. I have no control over this. But we are going to be doing The Extravaganza in Denver on the 23rd of April, somewhere in the city of Denver. And all the details will be given out at the next week's show, but you could if you're interested. So by Monday the 9th, I should have all of this up on the website. You could buy tickets for both of those shows in Denver. One's on Thursday, one's on Friday, and that's it. And all of us will be there, including Kara.
Yay!
Mm-hmm. And it's going to be awesome. Have you guys ever been to Denver before? Anybody?
Never.
I used to live in Denver.
Yeah. I didn't know that, Ev.
Yeah. Oh, little factoid. About that you didn't know. That's right. For 1 year, 81 to 82, part of 81, part of 82.
It's a good city. Yeah. I like Denver.
Yeah, Colorado is pretty damn awesome. And I go because my company used to have a satellite office there. And my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law live there. So I go, I'm there at least once a year to see them. And I used to go for work all the time. So I know the city well. Denver is also a city where I had an armed guard put his hand on his gun because of something.
We talked about that.
Yes, remember that? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Very bad, yeah. Evan. Don't touch things in a museum. I can't believe I did that. Yeah. I was so stupid. So stupid when you're young. I was young.
Quickly, too, I realize I never informed our listeners of this. So I have a course available, it's a book available through Audible. This was produced with the Great Courses, but it's an audio book that you can only get through Audible. It's the Skeptic's Guide to Alternative Medicine.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Awesome. Yeah.
So check it out. Just search for that title on Audible and you will find it. I wrote this and recorded it last summer and it's now available. I think it's pretty good.
Where can they go get it, Steve?
Go to audible.com and search for The Skeptic's Guide to Alternative Medicine. All right. We have a great interview coming up with none other than Andrian, which I found out is the correct way to pronounce her last name. And it's as awesome as you think it's going to be, so take a listen. Joining us now is Andrian. Ann, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
I'm really happy to be with you.
Thank you so much for coming on our show. Jay and I were just telling you before we started recording, we've been literally lifelong fans of you and, of course, Carl Sagan. Cosmos, the series Cosmos, for me, was a complete game changer in terms of science communication. So I'm thrilled now that you're coming out with a sequel to the book, Cosmos Possible Worlds. So tell me, after so many years, why was now the right time to finally come out with a sequel to Cosmos?
Well, as you probably know, in 2014, we released Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, which was in the sequel to the first season. And now I've gotten the privilege and the honor to write and direct and produce Cosmos Possible Worlds, and to write the companion book. And why now? Well, first of all, there are a lot of stories in the cosmos. It's a very big place and virtually an infinite number of stories. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm kind of a hunter-gatherer of stories. And so for the second and third seasons of Cosmos, I've been saving them up. And why now? Because I wanted to create a vision of the human future that was not the dystopian one in which we're all living in shipping containers and everything is dead or dirty. I wanted to create a vision of a possible world, of a possible future in which we meet the challenges that we're facing right now of climate change, of the destruction of our biodiversity, of the destruction of environments. I wanted to depict what that world would be like, because I believe that dreams are maps, and that without a great dream of the future, you can't go anywhere. That's part of it. But also, I wanted to explore whether or not there was a scientific basis for my optimism. And to look back to the 40,000 generations of human beings who came before us, to see how they had often had their backs to the wall, and yet they endured, they worked and struggled to create the civilization that we have now. So I felt, and I know Carl felt, that because science and civilization are a generation-binding enterprise stretching back thousands of years, that anything that inspires us with the beauty and the revelations of science about the universe, anything that makes us feel more fully the great romance of being alive at this moment in a history of cosmic evolution that stretches back 13.8 billion years, the legacy of life itself on Earth, 4 billion years of struggle, all of it, so that we could be alive right at this moment. Well, that's a responsibility. And I don't think that we can look squarely at the challenges we face and meet them unless we start taking the revelations of science to heart, taking them, internalizing them. And I believe that if we can do that, then we will act in defense of our future and get to that time when humans are possibly arrayed on many of the worlds throughout the galaxy.
So you think that science is the salvation for mankind?
Well, you know, without science, so much of nature would be foreclosed to us. we would not have the tools that we need to fight the challenges that we're facing. And so, yes, science has known sin and done terrible things. Scientists have placed hideous weaponry in the hands of people who shouldn't have them. I plead guilty to all of that. By the same token, it was the scientists who first understood 70 and even 100 years ago that the lofting of vast quantities of carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere would lead to the climate change that we are living in right now. They deliver the goods, you know? Science can get you to Mars. Science can get you way beyond, as the Voyagers have gone. But you can't lie your way to Mars. What you need is a grasp on reality. And for me, the best way to get at that reality is science so far. It's the one that has changed everything in the last 400 years, from Galileo's first look through a telescope to us successfully sending our spacecraft to the stars. In 400 years, that's nothing. That's the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
So it's a very powerful methodology, but it's of no use if only a tiny elite few of us know how it works, know its values and its methods, its insights. They should belong to all of us so that we can be informed decision makers.
Yeah, I think that simultaneous sort of romanticism about science and respect for the power of science is, you know, your signature, you along with, you know, Carl Sagan. And I think what made Cosmos so powerful, and it certainly seems like we could use another huge dose of that in the world. So I share your optimism, but it does seem like we're going through a period where we have to remind people, as you say, reality matters. Did you have that in mind with this book, that you think, yeah, this is like, we need a dose of reality today?
With every beat of my heart these last 5 years. That's what I've been thinking. And yes, science has been under attack. It's been treated with contempt. Various of our leaders like to show off how ignorant they are by saying nuclear, you know, as if that's a badge of pride that they don't know how to pronounce a simple scientific word correctly. So much of it, you know, here we are. Let me ask you, you can heap scorn on the scientists. You can feel very proud that you don't know what they know. But who are you going to call when there's a coronavirus? Huh?
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, yep.
It's just simply, you know, when things hit the fan, it's amazing how much we can suddenly remember our debt to science and our need for it to solve these problems. You know, the scientists didn't screw up. They prophesied. Is that the right way to say that? They made prophecies. It'd be easier. They made prophecies about what climate change would do to our world 70, 100 years ago. You know, it wasn't, the scientists didn't screw up. They did what they were supposed to do. They sounded the alarm. We devoted a whole episode in the first season of Cosmos to warn about climate change and the problems that it would create for us. And, you know, people were just sleepwalking. And it's just such a tragedy that was the case.
Yeah, I mean, the denial has been exceptionally bad, and it's been very difficult for anyone that's been a fan of science or, you know, a science communicator in particular. You know, there's an ebb and flow to these types of things, and I think, you know, your book came out at probably one of the best times it could have, to give people not just an injection of, you know, the fun and amazement of it, but also the importance of science.
Thank you. I really hope it can have an effect. You know, our show and book is going to be in 172 countries. Think of the size of that platform and the potential to awaken future Carl Sagans and future Einsteins with this information. Think of the potential to awaken each of us to our responsibilities. That's the dream of the show. That it should grab you. It should be dramatic, entertaining. The VFX should be cinematic and really knock you out. But also, you should be left feeling something of that soaring spiritual uplift of knowing something about science. And knowing something about nature and the universe and the fact that we ourselves are part of the cosmos and we're a way for the cosmos to know itself. That's the whole idea at the heart of every season.
And what are you most excited about in terms of, so the book, the theme of the book is possible worlds. I mean, you're definitely giving us a history of how we got here, but then looking forward to where this can take us into the future. When you think about the next 100 years or so and the potential for what science can do for humanity, what gets you the most excited?
Well, the thing that excites me the most is the possible world that we ourselves and our grandchildren and other descendants can have on this planet. Throughout the book, we're exploring, and the series, we're exploring the means by which we can redeem our environment, redeem the climate, rid it of the burden of pollutants and greenhouse gases. We can do these things, but we can't do them unless we have the appropriate leadership that is, alert to what the scientific community can offer, not threatened by it. And so, for me, the greatest possible world is this one and what it could be like. There's a vision in the final episode of the series when we take the audience to the 2039 New York World's Fair. And there's a vision of the new Colossus in New York Harbor. You know, the Statue of Liberty lit up the world for about 100 years and made our country so strong, so much stronger than any other, because we welcome people from everywhere. And this new Colossus is a massive sculptural tree of life made from the carbon dioxide that has been taken back from the atmosphere and turned into calcium carbonate. So the thing that nature uses to make seashells and pearls, it's also calcium carbonate that we think at this point was possibly the first home for life on this planet. In Cosmos Possible Worlds, we'll take you to our latest creation myth, the scientific origin story that we have for this moment of how life began. It, like any other scientific idea, will always be open to revision if other evidence comes in that's more compelling. That's the great strength of science. That's why you can get to the planets and the stars by using science. And so, yeah, that world in which we've met this challenge is the one I love most, because I have children and grandchildren whom I cherish. And I do not want to see them in a world of hardships and struggle. I want life to be better for the next generations of humans. So there are many dreams in this series. We tell the story of the man who dreamed that no one would ever go to bed hungry again, and how he used his science to work towards that dream, and how he gave up his life to stand up for science in defense of the truth, even though he knew by speaking a simple sentence, it would result in his own torture and death. There are many never before told stories in the book and the series that I felt so privileged to be able to tell, because they are an existence theorem. You know, they are examples of why I think we have what it takes, the courage, the intelligence, the cleverness to get us through this difficult time. And, you know, I think that's something, I know that's something that I felt I needed. And since I feel like I'm like everyone else, I figured I would put it out there, because I'm sure there are other people who feel the same way.
So reading through the book, you know, the new Cosmos Possible Worlds, there's definitely this consistent poetry throughout in the way you describe things. And it's, you know, for me, totally reminiscent of the original, you know, Cosmos that you wrote with Carl Sagan. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on, you know, obviously that's who you are. It's a very deliberate style of science communication, which is very, very effective. I love it. But you know, just the similarity with the original Cosmos was striking to me. Is that something? What are your thoughts on, like, how much of that came from you versus Carl versus the interaction between the two of you? You know, where did that voice come from?
I think it's a voice that Carl began creating before he met me. But I think it's one that together we were able to take further. And, you know, the great thing about real love is that you can't really, you know, it's seamless. So I don't, you know, we taught each other so much. I am so indebted to him. I can't even quantify what I learned from him. But also, he would always say that he was learning things from me, too. And so, you know, Carl and I both came from virtually identical backgrounds. You know, lower middle class people who were the children of immigrants, who grew up in poverty, who managed to, you know, by dint of very hard work, managed to raise their families up to the middle class. And these were people who didn't have, except for my dad, really didn't have any advanced degrees or much of an education, but they were autodidacts. They were people who read voraciously. They educated themselves, and they gave their children this passion for learning. And they, not only that, but what both our parents did, which was so critical, was they honored our curiosity. And they convey to us how fascinating life in the world really is. And so when we found each other, it was as if we already knew the idiom of love. We spoke the same idiom of love because we come from a very similar place. And Cosmos, the Voyager interstellar message, contact, these were collaborations in which, of course, I didn't contribute the science. That was entirely Carl. And he was already a kind of peerless scientific imagination and a pathfinder in science long before he met me. But it was that mix of the love of history. I was already fascinated by the history of science before I knew him. And so it was that perfect union of these passions that made all those projects. And, you know, I know this sounds horrendously corny, but I really feel that the kind of rapturous love that we were in while we were doing the first Cosmos series, Voyager record, until the very last moment of his life, really contributed to something of what makes Cosmos unique.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, Steve, I know that, you know, your love affair with that show is probably much greater than mine because you were a little older. I remember watching it as a very young person. And, you know, I remember falling in love with Carl, like, just by the way, by his enthusiasm. He ignited in me a thing that has been lit my entire life. It was the first skeptical thinking I was exposed to. It was the first epic level of scientific passion I was exposed to. I didn't know that you could love science the way that he helped me get to. You know, and that, my God, did we need that? Did we need that at the time? Yes. Do we need it today? Yes. And that's why, like, when we were first talking about interviewing you and the fact that you had written another Cosmos book, we got so excited because we need it. That's why I said before, the world needs this book right now, desperately.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, first of all, for you to say that you think it's worthy of the original Cosmos is that's the highest compliment you could pay me. I obviously had very grievous trepidations beginning this project in 2008 for the second season, and then, you know, this third season and writing this book, because I know how big the shoes that I am walking in are. I mean, you know, I probably know that more deeply than anyone on earth, because not only did I know what a great poet and scientist Carl was, and what a great communicator. I mean, very few people know that Carl would schlep to immigration naturalization ceremonies. No press agent, nobody, for no other reason than he was such a conscientious citizen who understood that each and every one of us has to question authority. That's a tenet of the methodology of science, but it's also a basic tenet of democracy. And he was someone who really believed that these revelations about nature and the universe, they belong to all of us. And so for you to say, to compare the first Cosmos book, A Personal Voyage, which the Library of Congress is deemed one of the only 88 books that shaped America. Mm. For you to say that my new book is anywhere in that same class is the greatest thrill for me and so gratifying I can't even convey it.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for spending this time with us. We really appreciate it. It's been a great honor.
It's been a great pleasure for me. Jay, Stephen, thank you so much for spending this time and giving me this opportunity. I enjoyed every moment of it.
Great. Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is robots and cyborgs. These are all new news items. They're all new news items. Shit. They just happen to be in this theme. Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
Item number one. Researchers have developed the first robotic hand prosthetic with finger-level precise control. Item number two. Engineers have developed a robotic device that can draw blood and even insert catheters into blood vessels automatically. And item number three, researchers have developed smart contact lenses that can dynamically adjust their focal length to bring any distance into focus. All right, Kara, since you like this this theme this week, you can go first.
Boo! Okay, let's use them reasoning skills. All right, first robotic hand prosthetic with finger-level precise control. I know this has always been a difficulty, and it's hard because you're a little vague here, so I don't think you can tell me, but does this or does it not include feedback mechanisms? You probably can't tell me.
The thing is that you can move individual fingers dexterously with precision.
With precision, okay, yeah. There's a part of me that says the only way to do that precisely is to be able to feel how much pressure you're putting on it, or at least have some sort of mechanism there. Because we've had prostheses where you can move fingers, I think, but they like crush glasses and shit like that. Engineers have developed a robotic device that can draw blood and even insert catheters into blood vessels. That seems easy. I don't know why that just seems easy, like robo-surgery, but just on sticking in a catheter. Oh, into blood vessels. Woo-hoo, good. Not into, you know, woohoo. That wouldn't be fun. And then lastly, smart contact lenses that can dynamically adjust their focal length to bring any distance into focus. Okay, so here we go. Researchers have developed, engineers have developed, researchers have developed. So we know that none of this stuff is necessarily on the market yet. We know that none of this stuff is necessarily FDA approved yet. So that doesn't really help me.
Yeah, these are all news items, so these are not like on the market.
The thing that sounds the hardest would be the contacts to me. But we have autofocus and cameras, and we do have very, very small lenses, but the fact that it would autofocus in your eye and wouldn't like cut your eye open seems like it's probably the toughest one. So I think I'm gonna say that's the fiction. But honestly, they could all be science. Good job, Steve.
Okay, Evan.
All right. Robotic hand with finger level precise control. That's a nice step forward. If you can get it down to that level, you've pretty much got this thing solved. I mean, what else is there to do? And I know they had been working on it, and apparently they've reached it. So that's remarkable news. I do think that one is science. And then I was thinking also along the lines of Kara, like, the robotic device that can draw blood and insert catheters into blood vessels automatically. Sure, that does seem like the most plausible, I think, of the three. By default, it leaves the contact lenses as being the fiction. And although I cannot put my finger on it, I did some research somewhat recently in the last year or so about smart contact lenses. I think perhaps it was in context with a news item having to do with, it wasn't Google Glass, but it was other smart device essentially that you're going to put into your eyes, and that they were having trouble with that. It was still many generations away from, I think, what's being described here, that we can't get this to adjust the focal length in this capacity is how it's described in this setting. So yeah, I'll agree with Kara. I think the contact lenses is the fiction. We're not there yet.
Okay, Jay?
I'm just going to cut to it. I'm pretty sure that the contact one is the fake. And again, you know, I think part of the problem, I was agreeing with what Evan was saying, it's getting it to function properly and be able to read what focus your eye needs. But I'm not even sure they have a way to power something like that yet, let alone like what would the actual mechanism be that would be changing. So that one to me is definitely the fiction, way above the other two.
Okay. And Bob.
Yeah, I can't disagree with what everyone's saying. I think the autofocusing sensors for a camera—they're just—they're complex and they're bulky. You know, even with today's technology, when you think of a contact lens, it's just so tiny. I just think that we are not there. I mean, how would you change the focus? I mean, would you have any control over it? You know, who knows what you want to focus on? I guess they could mimic a camera, but then again, it's just too bulky for a contact lens. Doesn't make, you know, I don't think we're ready for that yet. So I'll say that's fiction as well.
Okay, so you guys are all bunched up on number three. So let's start with number one.
Steve, have a nice sweep here.
Researchers have developed the first robotic hand prosthetic with finger-level precise control. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is cool. This is really, really cool. It's not just the increased dexterity and precision that they garnered. It's how they got it. So this is an amputee's, and the robotic prosthetic is controlled by nerve endings, not by the brain, right? So you're not communicating from the brain to the device. You're communicating through your existing nerves, you know, in the stump, basically, and then those signals are being used to power the device. But here's the new bit, and this is really cool. What they did was, so part of the problem with the with using stump nerve endings to control a prosthetic is that the signal in those nerve endings is teeny tiny, so it's really hard to read, and there isn't much discrimination because like you basically need the whole nerve to fire in order to get enough of a signal. So there's also a problem because that end of the nerve can die back. It can cause an neuroma. You know, it can basically bundle up on itself. It's scar. Mm. You get scar tissue, and also, how are you interfacing with that nerve ending? You got to stick something in it, like a little electrode in the nerve, and that scars over, and it's bad. So this is what they did. They took tiny muscle grafts and they teased apart the end of the nerve so that there was multiple endings that they connected to multiple different muscle grafts.
Wow.
Like when you unfray a wire?
Yeah.
A bunch of hairs come out?
Yeah, so you have multiple different endings that are all going to a clump of muscles. Now, those muscles aren't functionally doing anything, but the electrical signal created by a patch of muscles contracting is 100 times as strong as a nerve fiber. So basically, they're using muscles as an amplifier.
Ha!
What?
That's amplification. Nuts.
It's also stabilizing the nerve ending. And so there's no scar tissue. There's no, you know, neuroma. So it's biologically more stable. The signal, they can separate the signal out because those bits of nerve endings are going to be amplified by the muscles themselves. And then they connect those muscles to the receivers in the robotic hand. And so you can control each finger individually, and the thumb can move in multiple directions, and it can do, you know, you could grab things with a pincer, but it's not just like two states, like open, close. You can do multiple different states. You can grab a sphere. And of course, you know, they always highlight the really positive feedback. So the subjects who are, you know, using the prototypes are effusive, at least the ones that they, you know, are showing in the interview, saying, oh, it feels right. like I have my hand back. It's awesome. Mm.
How much training is required?
So apparently not much.
Mm, really? Wow.
Yeah.
What does the stump look like? What is it, I mean, what is your stump? Does it, your stump have a permanent kind of funky thing on it?
Like a like a cup link or of some sort?
Yeah, it looks like there is a connector at the end of the stump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like otherwise there would be like a pretty bad infection risk, right? Like yeah. you'd have to figure out a way to completely close it off.
So here's the other thing, Bob. They say they're also using algorithms to train with the signals so that cool. they claim that the person can use it the first try. Like there's you don't even really need it. So they train the wow. algorithm, not the person.
That's that makes cool. sense.
Programmed it to help you.
Yeah, so it's wow. kind of like pre-programmed to work.
And is there a delayed response, Steve? So if my brain were to say, okay, pinch my thumb and forefinger, would it take a second or two for that signal to get there? Or do you think it's more instantaneous? Like
I bet you it's as fast as...
It's why wouldn't it be as fast as... Yeah, right? Nerves are not instantaneous. They travel at a certain speed.
Just because of the amplifier and the cup link and yeah. the pieces in between, if that causes a delay of any kind.
It's probably not significant.
Negligible. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So how do they move it? Are they trying to actually imagine moving their pointer
yeah.
finger?
Yeah.
And then, holy crap.
But you almost don't have to. You know, it's funny. It's kind of like this idea, right, Bob, of like metacognition. Like, oh, I'm thinking about how I'm thinking. But it's so automatic that even if somebody has lost the ability to move their fingers, they don't have to go, I am now moving my left finger.
Yeah, just
like,
do it by reflex.
You just do it.
Pick up the ball. It's like, just pick up the ball and then just reflexively
just
reach
do
out
it.
And pick it up. You won't even think about it. Yeah.
It's
that
so
is
cool.
incredible.
Yeah.
Steve, I wonder if someone who was born without an arm can do this. In other words, if you lost, it's one thing if you've lost an arm. No problem. There.
Now, I used to, like, if you asked me 20 years ago, I would have said, "Oh, no way, they don't have the brain region for it." But what we've learned in the last 20 years is that the brain is plastic enough that it doesn't matter. You could have six arms, your brain will control them, no worries.
But would it probably take some, like, a little bit more learning?
It would probably be like your offhand, right? Not your dominant hand.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you'll
see. Trying to
it'll
write
feel
with your
like your left hand if you're right handed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but your brain has no problem mapping itself to new outputs. It can do that. It's not a problem.
Oh, that's true. We've seen it when you would take a monkey and graft a bunch of extra fingers on there.
Or whatever.
Yeah, your homunculus is totally versatile and adaptable.
Yeah, it is. It is more so than we thought. Okay, let's jump to number three. Researchers have developed smart contact lenses that can dynamically adjust their focal length to bring any distance into focus. You guys all
I
think this one
to feel about this.
Is the fiction.
It is?
You guys all think this one is a fiction. So here's the thing. So do any of you guys know what accommodation is?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
What?
Yeah.
Kara knows.
Well, I plan our accommodations every time we travel.
Yeah.
I mean, are you talking about how we round up and flatten out our lens in order to change our focal distance?
Yeah, and your pupil
will
using change.
These little muscles.
Your pupil size will also change based upon where you're focusing. So your eye itself is like the iris is moving and that's changing. So all you really need is something that will subtly change its shape. Based upon how you're focusing your eyes.
But I would think that would have to be implanted.
Yeah.
Why?
Like a new lens would have to be implanted.
Happens
would have
behind to be implanted. The eye.
It's not a new lens.
I don't know. Just the idea that...
It's just changing the shape of your cornea, right? That's how contact lenses
true.
Work.
True. Yeah. So, but the idea that it would sit on top and that it would be adaptable.
That's the whole point. It would have to be.
Input.
It would have to be dynamically adjustable, but it only would have to subtly change its shape. It wouldn't have to focus like a camera lens. Like there wouldn't have to be any motors or anything in there. It just have to be something that would respond to your eye by changing its shape.
It could adjust to light. It seems like easier. You have a certain like transitions lenses, right? You have a certain amount of light in, and it could maybe darken or lighten if you had a problem with your pupillary, you know, changes. But the idea of changing shape based on focal length, I feel like it requires feedback that a contact lens couldn't possibly.
Right.
No. Like, how does it know what
unless
you're
looking
at?
Unless it was a nano-structured contact lens.
Shit.
Oh, I see.
Which we don't have yet because this is the fiction.
Right. Yeah, we're not there yet.
But this is what I want. I want these contact lenses.
Yes, please.
So then you don't have to wear reading glasses as you get older.
So basically anybody could put these contact lenses in and then everything's in focus. They're multifocal, you know.
And you don't need a prescription anymore. Yeah,
right. Oh, that would be awesome. But yeah, these are unfortunately, sadly, this is the fiction. Damn. Yeah, I think we're a little bit away from this. This means that engineers have developed a robotic device that can draw blood and even insert catheters into blood vessels automatically is science. This is actually a little bit harder than you might think. I mean, hitting a deep blood vessel precisely so it doesn't roll away and doesn't burst and you insert a catheter cleanly into it takes a lot of skill. That's why it's hard.
That's true.
It's hard to do.
But visualizing a blood vessel seems like a machine could do it better than a person.
Well, so this is what the machine does. It uses ultrasound and infrared in order to
see. Infrared. I knew infrared was
it. Yeah, in order to see the blood vessels. And then it basically uses AI to sort of learn how to do it properly. And
so it doesn't do like stick, 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 and then get in?
Well, the guy.
It actually goes first time.
Well, yeah. Well, it wants to maximize its first time success, you know.
Yeah.
The claim is that they can get this better than people, you know, better than trained blood draws or, you know, physicians or nurses who do this all the time. Because it's still hard, you know, especially on people who have challenging blood vessels. Not everybody's easy. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. Yeah. If you have a nice, honking, big, juicy blood vessel, you know, vein, it's easy. That's the one a medical student can get with no problem, right? But
I have one like that, so they can always stick it. But every so often they say there's a valve or something in there. There's like some sort of thing where they'll stick it and then nothing comes out. Yeah.
But, yeah. But if you have somebody who's a difficult stick, cause they have bad vasculature, then this could be very, very useful if it could really help localize an image and isolate, you know, the artery and stick it. But this also, you know, is anticipating an era of automatic AI-guided surgery, at least for certain procedures. There's lots of things that we do, you know, that are just skills that somebody has to develop to do that procedure. And I always, when I was doing them, you know, during my training, that would thought, God, if I could just see the anatomy, you know, if I could just had ultra, like X-ray vision or whatever.
X-ray vision.
This would be so much easier, you know. I'd be trying to find some small space with a long needle, and it's challenging. There's things that we do that are difficult. So any technological advance in this era is welcome because it could reduce complications, reduce pain, obviously, on the part of the patient. It could be great for emergency situations, like you can have one of these on the ambulance, you know, to get an IV in, you know, very, very quickly, or in areas that are underserved and don't have enough people who are skilled in doing this. It could be useful.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it could actually help people downstream. I remember when my dad had a pulmonary embolism, the ambulance had to stick him multiple times.
That's very common.
And they used really big needles. Then later when he was on blood thinners, his arm just kept bleeding.
Oh,
and they couldn't, you know, it was like, ooh, what's going on here? Because he had so many stick marks.
Yeah. Oh, it's right. Yeah. I think the success rate in a hospital setting for sticking for an IV is only on the first try is only like 50%.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of people are getting stuck multiple times. And if you're somebody who has bad veins, that's like your life in the hospital is like people are constantly trying to stick you and you can't get anywhere. And then you might have to get a central line just so we can get access. Mm. And that has its complications. You know, you can get infected, et cetera.
Risk.
Yeah. Or if you're a bleeding risk, it's like contraindicated in some cases. So, yeah, this you know, seems like a deceptively little simple device, but it's actually fairly sophisticated to be able to do this well. And it would be a really, really useful. All right. Well, good job, everyone. I didn't sucker you in with my sci-fi contact lenses. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right, let's talk about vaccinations with this quote. Here we go. The return on investment in global health is tremendous, and the biggest bang for the buck comes from vaccines. Vaccines are among the most successful and cost-effective health investments in history. Truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
Seth Berkley, epidemiologist, CEO of the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunology. He's also the founder and former president and CEO of the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. Take that, anti-vaxxers. It's true. The return on investment is just beyond
astounding.
It's massive. Yeah. It's the most cost-effective and just effective risk versus benefit of any health intervention we've ever developed. which is why the anti-vaccine nonsense is so frustrating. You know, like, there's nothing better in terms of risk versus benefit than vaccines.
Yep. So we can't talk about it enough. Thank you, Seth Berkley.
All right. Thank you, Evan. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
You got it, brother. Fun times.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.